Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, Phil Sletten, Senior Policy Analyst at the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, and Concord's Policy Director Tori Gorman will join the show to discuss how the most vulnerable populations in New Hampshire have been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic, why the first budget of a new presidential administration is important, and recent economic trends and jobs data. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that a dispute over veterans' health care funding is holding up bipartisan negotiations on the framework for an omnibus spending package that would avoid a government shutdown next month. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy is arguing that $12.5 billion for veterans' medical care should not be classified as emergency spending that is exempt from budget caps, while the White House has sent mixed signals on whether it supports the position of House Democratic and Senate GOP leaders that the veterans' money should be exempt. A two-year budget deal in 2019 imposed limits on discretionary spending, and exempting the veterans' funding from those limits would free up more money for other non-defense programs. Overall, non-defense accounts would see an increase greater than 2% on average for the budget year that began October 1st, as opposed to a less than 0.5% boost without the veterans' healthcare carve-out. McCarthy opposes the exemption because it would bust the two-year budget agreement and allow appropriators to spend more money on non-defense programs. House lawmakers left Washington for the Thanksgiving recess with no sign of progress on a new coronavirus relief package. Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, and President-elect Joe Biden met last week in Wilmington, Delaware to talk about their agenda. Publicly, their position has been that Republicans ought to drop their opposition to a $2 trillion-plus aid bill in the lame duck session. But with pressure coming from all sides, even some top Democrats admit a smaller band-aid that could tide over lawmakers until after Biden takes office would be better than nothing. The lack of progress toward an aid deal has frustrated lawmakers from both parties as COVID-19 cases spike across the country and experts predict a hard winter ahead. Nearly 11.5 million Americans have been infected and nearly 250,000 have died, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. New unemployment insurance claims were up last week, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and key support programs are set to expire December 31st. House Democratic leaders are proceeding with plans to bring back earmarks for the 117th Congress, according to Majority Leader Steny Hoyer. Hoyer said in an interview that sometime after the Appropriations Committee's new chairwoman is elected the week of November 30th, she'll begin soliciting House lawmakers to ask for congressional initiatives for their districts and their states. Hoyer and the candidates to become chairwoman support transparency measures similar to those in place a decade ago before the practice was banned entirely. That includes making a project's requester publicly available, as well as the justification for spending taxpayer dollars on it, and clearly noting in legislation which provisions constitute member-requested items. Up next, Phil Sletten, Senior Policy Analyst at the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute, will be joining me to discuss how the most vulnerable populations in New Hampshire have been impacted by COVID-19. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Phil Sletten. Phil is the Senior Policy Analyst for the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute. He previously served as a performance auditor for the New Hampshire Office of Legislative Budget Assistant, where he provided analysis on a wide range of state agency operations, co-authored reports on various state programs within the Department of Transportation, Safety, and Health and Human Services, as well as the Veterans Home. He also conducted research related to the community college system. Phil's been non-Facing the Future before, usually to provide a unique perspective on how state and federal policy interact in New Hampshire. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Phil.
Thank you very much, Chase. It's great to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you on the program. And what prompted having you on the show this week, you recently wrote an issue brief that touched on new and expanded challenges facing vulnerable populations in New Hampshire during the pandemic and how COVID-19 has impacted those populations. So I'm going to jump right in and maybe start with a more generic or basic question. You mentioned that that COVID-19 has had a widespread impact on life in New Hampshire, but especially negatively impacted a lot of vulnerable populations throughout the state. I just wonder if you could identify what you would say are the most vulnerable populations in New Hampshire right now.
Right. So everyone is at some level of increased risk, right? That's something associated with this pandemic. I'll note that the economic impacts have been particularly widespread. Nearly half of households in New Hampshire reported losing employment income between March 13th and mid-July. So that's a large swath of households that are seeing some of their income from work being reduced over this time period during the pandemic. Jobs at the lower end of the pay scale, particularly some analysis showing that jobs that paid under $27,000 a year in 2019, those have been the slowest to come back in 2020 in New Hampshire. We've seen that jobs at the high end of the wage spectrum and the middle end appear to have come back, if not fully, at least most of the way there, whereas jobs at the low end of the pay scale have been down quite a bit. So for folks who typically work in those low wage sectors or previously had a low wage job, an optimistic take would be that maybe some of them moved to middle wage work or higher wage work, but many of them are likely still not finding employment opportunities because those jobs have been so slow to come back. Now, individuals and families living in situations that make distancing difficult, such as crowded apartment buildings or congregate living facilities or in homes where many rooms are shared among lots of people, those folks are also particularly vulnerable, especially on the health side. But that's, of course, related to resources. For folks who have more resources, they may be able to avoid some of those situations. And people who have face-to-face interactions in their employment and who may be expected to go to work because they've been deemed essential workers at some point, or they're working in a service industry that doesn't really facilitate working from home or whatever it may be to try and avoid some of those health risks. Those folks are certainly at health risk and also may be at financial risk depending on what happens with their employer's business. Older adults is another category of folks who are definitely at risk in this pandemic. We've seen some of the statistics suggesting that older adults are more likely to have negative health impacts. That's something we've seen, especially in congregate living facilities and nursing homes, or even individuals in their own homes. And those folks who require services and need someone to come visit them to provide those services, they're also vulnerable. Similar with individuals experiencing disabilities. And also identify that people who identify themselves as something other than white and non-Hispanic, they've been more likely to contract the 2019 novel coronavirus and to encounter it in New Hampshire. And that's something that we see across the country. And one thing I do want to note too is that there's overlaps in interactions among all these groups, right? So for example, there are higher poverty rates and lower median household incomes for people identifying as Black or African-American or Hispanic or Latino or two or more races in New Hampshire. And those factors obviously interact to make these populations particularly vulnerable.
You know, New Hampshire is a very small state relative to many other states in our great union. I think we have, less than 1.5 million people, if I'm remembering correctly. Oh. Perhaps our population has grown since then.
1.359 million, if you want to know.
All right, I'm right on target there. So how large are some of these vulnerable populations? So is it a broad swath across our state? Is it relatively small? Can you give me just some context as to how many people we're even talking about here?
Yeah, so if we consider the income question, right? How many people have very low income? If we use the poverty definition, then we're talking about a little under or about 100,000 people in poverty in New Hampshire based on the most recent data we have. So a little over 7% of the state's population. And as a reminder, when we're talking about poverty, we're talking about a really low level of income, right? $13,000 a year for an individual, $21,000 a year for a family of three. You know, so it depends on the household composition where that poverty threshold is. But that's, you know, close to or about 100,000 people a year. About 10% of the population in New Hampshire identifies as something Other than white and non-Hispanic, so they identify as non-white for their race or as Hispanic for their ethnicity. And about 19% of New Hampshire's overall population are over the age of 65 years. So that potentially puts them at greater risk as well.
And I think you were touching on earlier about some of the support the state has provided to some of these vulnerable populations. Can you break down what we saw coming from the state before the pandemic, maybe some new relief or aid that's come along during the pandemic? And just for the benefit of our national listeners, I'm wondering, is there any federal overlap there?
Yes, there's absolutely federal overlap. So when the pandemic first struck, the state started to quickly take some actions, even before the federal government took some of their largest actions in response to the pandemic. So expanded unemployment compensation, making sure that more people were eligible for unemployment. And making sure that people were eligible for unemployment, even if they weren't able to, you know, sort of find work again, or they weren't looking for work at that time. So essentially providing income support. That is something that the state took early on, as well as a moratorium on evictions and foreclosures, making sure that people are able to stay in their homes and have that stability. So both income stability and a stability in terms of, you know, being displaced during a pandemic is, being displaced is never a good thing, especially not a good thing during a pandemic. But the federal government's assistance to the states, particularly through the CARES Act coronavirus relief funds, those were really instrumental in permitting the state to really expand a lot of its supports, both to healthcare institutions, to individuals who needed assistance paying for housing, and to businesses. There were quite a few supports provided to businesses in particular, with some targeting towards smaller businesses. So there was also assistance to food banks, assistance to nonprofits. So there were quite a few supports that the state was able to implement, with largely funded by the federal dollars that came in. The state revenue side dropped quite a bit, so there weren't as many state dollars available to fund some of the usual state supports. But because any COVID-19 related expenditures could be covered by those federal coronavirus relief funds, the state was able to implement and support quite a few programs that were targeted at, you know, sort of keep bolstering the economy or keeping people running through, keeping people supported through the worst period of the pandemic.
You mentioned how the state dollars have fallen during the pandemic, and a lot of other states across the country are in a similar circumstance. There's a debate at the federal level as to what kind of state aid should be coming in terms of an additional COVID-19 relief package. But before we get to that point, I wonder, can you highlight if there's been any programs or usual support that took place before the pandemic that's sort of gone by the wayside, or hasn't had the ability to provide relief because there's been no funding there because we've been so focused on the pandemic?
Yeah, so the state has stopped the start of some programs or some projects, has curtailed some of the more discretionary spending, if you will, so it has to a certain extent. Some of the hiring has been pulled back, and that has likely affected some state programs. Some state programs' funding was reshuffled for some period of time as well. But because of two factors, one, the state of New Hampshire has a two-year state budget, so there was not a need to craft a new and balance a budget within the window thus far in which the pandemic struck. And the federal government has provided significant amounts of COVID-19 related aid. That has made it so that a lot of those services haven't had to be curtailed at this point. There are some that have been, or have been at least adjusted. However, a lot of the aid to the most vulnerable populations in the state, especially those that are supported by federal dollars, such as SNAP benefits, which haven't been increased, but have been allowed to go to the maximum for people, for the maximum benefit for people, regardless of what their income is within the eligibility threshold, and pausing Medicaid disenrollments. Those are things that are supported by a combination of federal and state dollars, but are really, you know, the federal government has provided a lot of that support, particularly SNAP benefits are all federal benefits, and the federal portion of Medicaid has increased. So again, the federal government's interaction with the state during this time period has been important for keeping a lot of those services running. That being said, a lot of that federal support is expiring or has already expired in some cases, and some of it maybe is expiring at the end of the year. Some of it's on a slightly different timeline, but we are looking at these sort of temporary measures that we saw from the federal actions earlier in the year. And those temporary measures are now either have expired or many of them are running to the end of their course.
This may or may not be a great question for you because you're not within the government, but when you're looking at the numbers for the state, does it appear that New Hampshire is, I guess, overextending itself in some of these areas of investment in hopes that additional federal aid would be coming? Or is it once we're out of aid and support, we're just, you know, scaling back or cutting off programs entirely?
The state government has paced some of the expenditures associated with, especially the CARES Act coronavirus relief funds. The state government has paced out some of those expenditures over the course of the year. Those funds, I should note, have to be spent or returned to the federal government by December 30th of this year. So it was a significant amount of dollars, and New Hampshire is $1.25 billion, which for a state that has a general fund of about $1.6 billion is a significant amount of money. So, but those have to be spent on COVID-19 related aid and can't be spent on pre-existing programs, right? They can't be spent on previously budgeted expenditures. So it's all, I shouldn't say all, but many of it is new programs, right? And those dollars have been paced out a little bit more over time. There are still a fair number of those dollars left. So the state will actually be finding ways to spend them before December 30th, because again, under federal law, they'd have to be returned. But the governor has noted that in his budget process, when he's crafting the next two-year state budget, and his proposal is going to come to the legislature by February 15th of next year, he stated that there may be federal aid coming, there may not be, but we should assume that there isn't and build the budget around that. And one piece that I think is important to remember is if that federal aid weren't there, we would likely be seeing state agencies overspending their state budgets to meet needs. But because that federal aid has been there, state agencies have been able to underspend their budgets. What that means for the next state budget, it means that a lot of these programs are likely at risk, or there's questions about where the funding sources come from to continue providing these supports. So what the federal government's actions are, either before December 30th or afterwards, could have a pretty big impact on what services are provided in the next state budget and how they're funded.
So Phil, we've touched on identified some of the vulnerable populations in the state, the different types of aid or relief that has come in since the pandemic, pre-pandemic. You touched on how businesses have been supported in some respect. I don't want to get you in trouble, but if you were to put on your advocacy hat in a way, or at least your policy advocacy hat, when you're looking at the state's needs right now, those vulnerable populations, and you look at the potential for additional relief, whether it's from the state or in part from the federal government, are there areas of need that are just abundantly clear to you that we really need to be funneling additional revenue into this because of this particular vulnerable population or this particular aspect of our economy?
Right. So given that there's limited resources and we have to deploy them in certain places, I would say that one of the first areas you'd look at is protecting older adults, especially older adults in nursing homes and congregate living facilities. We've seen the health impacts be pretty severe in those situations. So thinking about that in the context of funding health services, that's a critical area, especially, again, older adults, folks with disabilities, people who need services that often require in-person interaction. There's increased risk there, and having more protections and resources available in that sector in particular is important. Second, and this is both, protecting health and protecting the economy and protecting people's ability to make ends meet, aid to individuals who are either have lost their job or are low-income individuals or both, that aid is critical for their ability not just to sort of pay bills in the short term, but also to support the economy in the long term, because those dollars are then generally put back into the economy in a relatively direct manner. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the SNAP program I mentioned earlier, which is known as the food stamp program here in New Hampshire, that has been shown based on prior studies. There was a study from Moody's Analytics, for example. There's also studies from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which administers the program. That's been shown to have a positive return on investment, if you will, when it comes to economic support. For every dollar invested in the federal SNAP benefits in 2009, during the last recession, during the beginning of the recovery and the end of the last recession, the beginning of the recovery from, I should say, the last recession. The Moody's Analytics identified that for every dollar invested in the program, there was $1.74 of economic activity that was generated. So that, and that was of the programs it looked at, of the policy options Moody's Analytics looked at, that was the highest return on investment. Also, unemployment compensation ranks highly in both that examination and some other analyses, including from the Congressional Budget Office. So those are areas where providing those resources to people, to low-income folks, to folks with really limited resources or fewer resources than they had before, that's both helping them directly, meeting their bills each month, and providing economic stimulus. And that's especially important for families that are low-income families with children, because having children in the picture means there may be childcare costs or childcare duties, and also education duties that didn't previously exist that may make it more difficult for those families to be able to engage in work and to be able to provide the support that they need to for both their kids and the financial support for the household.
Are there any, I guess, exacerbated challenges that you anticipate will linger amongst these vulnerable populations beyond the pandemic, say beyond the next year, or maybe even some new forms of relief or aid that have been started during the pandemic that you think are wise to keep going as we work to help these particular populations within the state or even around the country?
Yeah, so in terms of the lingering challenges that I think we'll see, some of them are actually carried forward from before the pandemic and have just been, as you said, exacerbated. Affordable housing is particularly a problem in New Hampshire. Housing takes a long time to construct. There was a housing shortage beforehand, especially on the rental side of the market, where more low-income families and workers are relying on rental housing. The affordable housing challenges that we've had have only been exacerbated during this crisis, especially since there's been some pretty substantial changes in the housing market. That's going to be an ongoing challenge, especially if people have lower incomes and housing costs are higher. Also, wages for low-income workers. Historically, during the last recovery from the last recession in particular, those wages did not grow very fast coming out of the last recession. And it may take a long time to recover those lost wages, and particularly after this crisis, given the lack of jobs at the low end that we've seen, the lack of recovery there, and the increased unemployment rate, there may not be the upward pressure on those wages that we saw in New Hampshire when the unemployment rate, for example, fell below 3% and was below 3% for several years. That really put upward pressure on those low-end wages and, you know, may have had other benefits like increased food security, increased ability to pay for housing. That helps the economy overall. And that's something that took a long time to materialize after the Great Recession. So that's something that I'll certainly be watching for. There may be medium and long-term shifts as well in what the economy looks like, particularly for low-wage workers. When we're thinking about accommodation and food service industries, how those have changed, how those not just change in the short term, but over the course of the long term, service industries may look quite a bit different. It could be disruptive to the economy, particularly in the low-wage sectors. In New Hampshire, it did also take a long time for food insecurity to drop back to pre-recession levels after the Great Recession. So that'll be important to watch during this crisis and recovery as well. So there are some supports, some policies that also have put sort of benefits towards people who have these low and moderate incomes. And we can see that based on what we saw from the last recession, some of those may be helpful to continue when we look at the economic recovery going forward.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to me and Phil Sletten from the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute discuss how the pandemic has impacted vulnerable populations in New Hampshire, challenges that have cropped up during the pandemic, and how state and federal relief has been used to support those vulnerable populations. Thanks for joining the
show.
Thanks
for having me, Chase.
Up next, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Policy Director Tori Gorman will join the show to discuss why the first budget of a new presidential administration matters and provide an update on recent congressional processes and economic trends. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Tori Gorman and Bob Bixby. Tori is the Concord Coalition's Policy Director. Bob is Concord's Executive Director. Both are regular contributors on the show. Welcome back, Bob and Tori.
Thank you, Chase.
Hey, Chase.
Happy to have you both on the program once again, talking about some very important topics. One is going to be talking about the next administration's first budget. Then we might get into some economic and jobs data and a little more from there. But first, I'm going to kick it off with you, Bob. We're talking about the first budget of the next president. What is it and why does it matter?
Well, first, let me say this is this reminds me of like a lot of virtual Thanksgivings that we're going to see this week with it's just all in the family here on this segment from different locations. So happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Every time a new administration comes in, the first budget that they present is usually very important because it can set the tone and a legislative agenda for really the next 4 years. I mean, if you look back at, say, the Reagan budget with the big tax cut proposal, the Clinton budget, which was big on a deficit reduction plan, George W. Bush's big tax cut proposal, Obama's healthcare plan, first budgets are usually very important. And I think this one will be because Joe Biden ran on a lot of big ideas and we have a big economic crisis to go with the healthcare crisis. So I expect that we will be picking apart parts of the Biden first budget for the next 4 years. He's got an unusual amount of challenge. I mean, a new incoming administrations often, you know, have some challenges when they come in. But here, you know, he's going. I mentioned the healthcare, obviously the COVID crisis, but he's going to have to maneuver through a very closely split Congress. At this point, we don't know exactly what's going to happen with the Senate since there are those two Georgia races that are still outstanding. But no matter what happens there, it's going to be a very close split in the Senate. The Democrats lost seats in the House, so they will still have the majority, but by a smaller amount. And that means that it's going to be, and let me add to that, that there are pretty significant partisan differences within the Democratic Party. I shouldn't say partisan, but inter-party divisions that were put on the back burner during the campaign. But when you start putting out actual budget proposals and you're dealing with issues like climate change and healthcare, criminal justice, education, housing, climate change, some big proposals that Biden made during the campaign, it's going to be interesting to see whether he hones some of those back because of the closeness of the Democratic majority in the House and the improbability of getting some of that stuff through the Senate in such close votes. It'll be very, very interesting to see where he ends up on that. He's got a couple of things that really are sort of sleeper issues beyond the immediate, which I think are going to be very important. One is the debt limit. The debt limit is going to spring back to life at the end of July, like Frankenstein's monster. And in order to keep funding the government, borrowing money to keep the government going, something is going to have to be done about the debt limit. So it'll be interesting to see if there's a plan for that. Towards the end of his term, the Medicare Part A trust fund is facing insolvency. May not be something that we're looking at right now, but I will certainly be glancing to see what impact the budget might have on that. The highway trust fund needs replenishing even before that. So look, we got short-term issues and some longer-term issues. Longer-term, in this case, I'm looking at just the end of his first term. And I can mention at the end of his first term, the individual provisions of the 2017 tax cuts are due to expire. So you can throw that into the mix too to see what assumptions are made in the budget. So look, I'm very much looking forward to it. It should be a good policy debate that will be kicked off by this budget.
I wanted to comment real quickly, Bob. I think there are a couple of things that might make this budget really interesting. First, it's also going to be the first budget without discretionary spending caps, right? So we are in the last year of the Budget Control Act. So it'll be interesting to see what the president proposes on the discretionary spending side. There are definitely some freedoms there that he's going to have that prior presidents have not.
And Tori, I've got a question for you. You're a former Senate staffer, so you've worked on the Hill for a number of years. And Bob made a point that basically the first budget of a president can largely just be a policy statement piece. So I'm curious from the the congressional perspective, how often and for what reasons might a president's first budget be dismissed out of hand or wholly accepted as a new agenda for the coming couple of years?
Well, Congress always likes to put their stamp on things, right? So I think, you know, people always sort of consider the president's budget dead on arrival, but Bob's right. It definitely, it sends a signal in terms of priorities. Let's keep in mind that the president still has to sign spending bills, and the executive branch is still the one that's responsible for implementing policy. So, I mean, we can talk about how the 4 or 5 volume behemoth budget that lands on everybody's desk in February is dead on arrival the minute it arrives. I think the president's influence in budgeting lives on. And I just wanted to go back one more point that I wanted to make when Bob was talking about the interesting things that we might see in the president's budget. It just dawned on me as he was talking about the tax cuts that are supposed to expire, the 2017 tax provisions for individuals and small businesses that'll expire in 2025. I'm wondering if the president's going to put forward a shorter budget to avoid having to address that question in his first budget. So, especially when we're worried about, fighting COVID at the same time, we've got, big annual budget deficits and big debt. One of the ways to sort of avoid that question altogether is just let's not talk about those tax cuts right now.
Yeah, my guess would be that sort of timing shift would take place. I'd be surprised if they laid out like a 10-year budget or mm-hmm. something like that. It'd mm-hmm. probably be the shorter they can feel like they can get away with, the better, because there are things looming towards those end points. The other thing is really how do they stick to PAYGO, or do they stick to PAYGO? That's going to mm-hmm. be a big deal. So that when Biden was running, he said, well, anything that's COVID related, you don't have to pay for because it's an emergency and we have to get the economy going again. But he did indicate a willingness or a desire or an intention to offset the cost of permanent new programs. That's where the tax increase ideas come into his budget. And so it's going to be interesting to see not only the credibility and adequacy of those offsets, but to what policies does he apply them? What is this split between an emergency pandemic-related bill and the so-called new programs that might be subject to PAYGO? Mm-hmm.
So, Bob, you mentioned a lot of potential issues that need to be addressed going into this first term. And Tori, you mentioned some of the trends like growing deficits or growing debt. My question for you, Bob, is the first budget, in being a statement piece, is it an opportunity to show how you might address a lot of different issues? Or is it more likely that an incoming President Biden would really hone in on a couple things like just the pandemic or just the health crisis? Or is it really an opportunity to display all the priorities that he might want to pursue over 4 years?
My guess, which is just a guess and worth not a hell of a lot, is that what we're going to see first is a big, 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 big focus on the pandemic and all of the things associated with that. And that encompasses a lot. You look at the Democrats' Heroes Act that they were been trying to pass since May, and all the provisions, and that avoids any of the PAYGO issues because it's all, well, this is emergency and we have to get it done. Now, there might be something done actually before he takes office. I mean, the economy certainly could use it. But even so, my guess is that there'll be kind of like a phase one budget, which is, and any new incoming administration always does this. It's just like something that gets out quickly.
Skinny budget.
Yeah, the skinny budget. Yes, exactly. And this skinny budget is probably going to be,
Yeah, and skinny meaning bare bones, as in, not a lot of the, it's just usually a 4 or 5 volume set. This might just be a series of charts and policy proposals.
So I think we'll do that. The big policy proposal budget will come late, like in April or May or something like that. And that probably will have a lot of different stuff in it because he ran on a lot of different stuff.
And keep in mind too, a lot of this depends on whether or not Congress can get their work done, you know, this year. We still have not funded fully the fiscal year that we are in right now. We're still operating under a continuing resolution, which expires on December 11th. If Congress has to kick the can down the road again next year because they can't come to any kind of an agreement, that's going to delay the president putting out his own budget. It's hard to know what you're going to spend next year if you haven't figured out what you're spending this year.
Well, and one of the things I wanted to touch on, Tori, you just sort of took the conversation where I wanted to go anyway. I wanted to get an update from you just relatively quickly on, as we approach Thanksgiving, I think Congress is now in recess. Where do we stand on those appropriations bills and maybe even another round of COVID relief?
We're not as far along as I think anybody would hope to be at this point. The lawmakers have gone home for Thanksgiving break. They've only got a couple of weeks of legislating before the December 11th deadline. They've got 12 appropriation bills to pass at minimum, or choose another continuing resolution that extends the deadline. As far as getting the 12 appropriations bills, there are obviously several hiccups. We'll see if they figure them out anytime soon. As far as coronavirus relief, I think that initially there was the plan to sort of wait until the Biden administration was up and running before putting forward a coronavirus plan, knowing that they would have a friendly White House to sign the legislation. But it looks like the economy may need a boost, a shot in the arm before that happens, that waiting until sometime after January 20th. And let's face it, they probably wouldn't be able to legislate anything until early February. That's just simply too long. So it's definitely not as far along as we would hoped, and not as fully baked as we would hoped, but here's hoping they can put something together.
And I want to get to the economic data you were alluding to and how the economy probably needs another shot in the arm. But you mentioned a couple sort of bumps in the road or trip ups in this process. Were they anticipated? Are they what you would have expected would actually trip up Congress as they try to get these appropriations bills passed?
So as we were talking earlier, this is the last year of the Budget Control Act. Back in 2011, we passed legislation that capped discretionary spending for 10 years. This is the last year in which discretionary spending is capped via law, via statute. And in order to abide by the budget agreement that was implemented last year, the two-year budget agreement, we've got to pass these 12 bills within the discretionary caps for defense and non-defense spending. And on the non-defense side, a couple years ago, Trump administration passed legislation called the VA Mission Act, which allows veterans to get medical care off campus, if you will, outside of the VA system. There's been a lot of trouble in the VA system in terms of backlogs, et cetera. So the VA Mission Act allows veterans to get care off campus, if you will. That spending, though, falls under the discretionary spending caps, according to that VA Mission Act. It used to be mandatory spending, now it's discretionary spending. But because it's now discretionary spending, it falls underneath the caps. That's about $12.5 billion this year. There are several Democrats in Congress that are very interested in designating that spending as emergency, so that it does not count towards the spending caps, but they're getting some pushback from other members of Congress who said, no, 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 that would violate the spending agreement. And if we designate that spending as emergency, then that just means Democrats can go run away and spend $12.5 billion on other non-defense spending. And that's not fair. And that violates the agreement. So it'll be interesting to see how they handle that one.
And I want to jump back over to the economy issue we were talking about earlier and whether we're at a point where an additional shot in the arm is needed. So what are some of the recent trends you've seen in any economic data or jobs data that has been coming out in recent weeks?
So I mean, I think anybody who's been paying attention to the newspaper or their favorite TV news, we're aware that there's sort of a jobs recovery that started this summer and has continued into the fall. And it's reflected in the labor market data. You know, the unemployment rate has dropped from 14.7% in the spring to 6.9% now. Real GDP, economic growth. We had two consecutive quarters of negative growth. The second quarter of this year was hugely negative, but the third quarter showed a rebound. But I guess what I see happening, at least as it, where it comes to things like the coronavirus relief package, is I see a lot of members of Congress that are looking at that data and saying, see, the economy is on the rebound. We don't really need to do anything. And the problem I have with a lot of those statistics, at least right now, where we sit right now, is all of that stuff, all of that data is backward looking. The unemployment rate is backward looking. The economic growth data is backward looking. And where we sit right now, coronavirus cases are exploding around the nation. Various pockets of the economy are probably gonna have to resort to mini lockdowns, if you will, whether restaurants and bars close, gyms close, et cetera. And I think relying on economic data that's backward looking to drive policy that is forward-looking is very short-sighted. I mean, it's a mismatch, right? You're comparing apples and oranges, so to speak. Case in point, you take a look at initial unemployment claims. You know, those come out weekly. And last week, you know, we had 742,000 initial claims. That was an increase of 31,000 over the prior week. And the prior week was also revised upward. So when you take a look at the data that's released with more frequency, you can get the picture that the economy at its most benevolent level, the economic growth is slowing down, the jobs recovery is slowing down. But when you look at initial claims and the number of coronavirus cases and hospitalizations are up, et cetera, you can portend, if you will, what lies ahead. And that is what I think should be driving policy rather than the sort of backward looking economic data.
And Bob, I want to go to you as we close out this segment and get your sage advice, at least give it to policymakers. And Tory laid out a pretty nice case of, you know, why this backward-looking data might not provide the best benchmark points for crafting additional COVID-19 relief. So if you were talking to policymakers right now and giving advice on how to approach or how large this next package should be, what would you draw their attention to? And it could be as broad as the three T's we always talk about, or perhaps some pointed advice on where the biggest needs are.
Well, I think that they should probably pass the biggest package that they can get enough votes to pass. I do think that it's going to be important to give money to individuals. I mean, I think that there was the extended unemployment benefit. I mean, there are we don't have time to go into all of it, but there are a number of things that have already expired or that expire at the end of the year regarding additional supplemental extended unemployment benefits. For reasons that Tory laid out with the jobless claims and the unemployment rate, it's clear that the jobs market has not recovered and that we should be renewing extended unemployment benefits. They may not be at the same level that they were at the original CARES Act. I'm sure that now that the election's over, maybe they can negotiate the right level. But I think that's important because, you know, people are out of work through no fault of their own. It's, the job market is not robust enough that you can just say, well, people ought to be able to go out and find a job. So we don't need to give them any unemployment. I think that's important. I do think there's some money for state and local governments that are strapped and, otherwise it's just going to keep laying off people or having to raise taxes in a recession. It's not a good idea. So again, the level there is going to be something that's going to have to be negotiated. Yeah, those are probably the most important things. Some targeted relief to businesses like the Paycheck Protection Program, but they're going to have to look at that a little bit for, I think, some to make it more targeted.
I think there's some loopholes they've got to close there. Yeah,
I think there's sort of a consensus that it was a good thing to do emergency wise, but extending it, there's going to have to be some changes.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Tory Gorman. We discussed why the first budget of a new presidential administration matters, latest jobs data and trends, and recent economic data, as well as developments in the appropriations process and COVID-19 relief. Thanks for joining the show, Bob and Tory.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving back to you guys and to all of our listeners. You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.